We're going to be talking about the opioid epidemic. I hope that this epidemic has not touched you or your family or your friends, but I think it's important first to show how significant this opioid crisis actually is. And basically, it involves the use of opioids and people dying, getting sick, getting addicted to these pain-killing drugs. Examples would be Oxycontin, Vicodin, methadone, heroin. So we've got a lot of killers here that we're dealing with, and what we're going to try to do is use a praxeological public choice approach to understand where this crisis comes from and where it doesn't come from. In the United States, over the last 12 months, 50,000 Americans have died. That's a lot of people. Worldwide, it's estimated to have killed 400,000 people around the planet. Now, in the U.S., the number of people dying from opiate drugs, is basically only 2.8% of all deaths. That number appears to be small, but remember that includes all deaths. So, and most of people dying are dying of old age. They're dying basically at the end of their life, and it's not young people that are dying of heart disease and kidney failure and cancer for the by and large. So this is a pretty avoidable cause of death. And it's, as I said, it's much more dramatic than that 2.8% figure would indicate. But even given that low number, that number is still greater than the number of people who die from kidney failure, the number of people who die from pneumonia and the flu, and it's greater than the number of people who die from suicides. So by and large, the number of people dying, most of it's due to old age. Okay, in terms of Google searches, the opioid crisis brings in, in contrast to the number of people dying at 2.8%, the number of people who are searching on Google for this issue is only 1.3%. The New York Times article is only 0.4%. And in the UK, it's 0.3%. So the information is still not getting out to the general public about this problem. As I said, it's much bigger than you think, and yet it's much less reported or searched for, and that indicates almost a complete lack of information about this. 100 million Americans used one of these painkillers last year, whether it was for legitimate pain issues, or whether they were addicted to it. Doctors wrote legally 66 prescriptions per 100 American. So I think it's something like 20 out of 100 would be written a prescription and receive an average of 3.5 prescriptions. That's a huge number. 25 years ago, the use of these drugs was very limited, and only the illegal forms were really used. Okay. So it's a big deal, and it's something I hope to enlighten you about. Now, the statistics for 2015, the statistics are run a year or so behind. Okay, so this gives, I don't know how well you can see this back here, but synthetic opiates are down here. That's something like fentanyl. And then over here, you see heroin. And you see a big spike in fentanyl here starting in 2012. You see the spike starting for heroin in 2009. And then the next highest line is commonly prescribed opioids. This is natural and synthetic opioids and methadone. And then if you add all these up, you get this line, which is death by any opioid. And that's on the graph is about 10.5 deaths per 100,000 population. Now, this is 2016 data. You see the synthetic form of opioids causing more deaths. And if you add them all up, any opioid, it's risen to 13.5 per 100,000. So it's risen 3 deaths per 100,000 people in just that 1 year. So legal opioids are Oxycontin, Vicodin, and many others. The big thing that we're going to look at here today is that big pharmaceutical companies, big pharma, encourage new prescription writing guidelines on doctors. And, of course, the guidelines is the general rule that doctors are supposed to follow in terms of encouraging their use. Okay, so 25 years ago, doctors wrote virtually no prescriptions for these things, and today they're writing them like crazy. Of course, the physicians agree to this, but they're prodded along through several factors. And so now painful injuries are treated with opioids, but typically only in the short run, 30 to 60 days. So the football player who gets injured, the teacher who falls down the steps, the coal miner who wrecks his shoulder, the fisherman who cranks his knee and is in severe pain. Nowadays, if they go to the doctor, they're going to be written a prescription for maybe 90 pills, maybe 120 pills. And as a result, many people become addicted. We're going to look at the process. So just with legal opiates, you get 15,000 deaths per year. So here's the key thing. Why is there an epidemic? Well, first of all, they changed the guidelines in the year 2000. There's a committee of researchers, scientists, and doctors that meet on a regular basis to discuss pain prescription guidelines, events that have happened, statistics that have come out. But basically what's happened is they're writing millions of prescriptions for these things. And this is where the problem just starts. Remember, there's only 15,000, I say only 15,000. 15 out of the 50,000 deaths are as a result of taking legal drugs. Okay, but under this new form of prescribing, up to 25% of the people who are given a prescription experience some problem of misuse, taking too many, not taking them according to the prescription guidelines and so forth. 10% get opioid use disorder. Not exactly sure what that is, but it involves some combination of taking them incorrectly, taking too many in one day, going back to the doctor for additional prescriptions, or going to other doctors to get additional prescriptions. 5% transition to heroin, which is in the black market, basically. 80% of heroin users today start with legal prescriptions. So you see how the problem is sort of spreading out. The number of overdose deaths increases dramatically in 2015 by an estimated 50% compared to today. So even though we've recognized the problem, this is a horrific problem, and it's one that's not easily dealt with. Again, I hope you haven't experienced addiction or in your family and friends, but it's a truly vexing problem for individuals. So today we've got more than 2.5 million addicts. And just to mention the pain epidemic, basically, studies have found a very large percentage of adults have chronic pain. If you looked at the European countries and Israel, the average was 19% of all adults. In 2011, the study found 116 million Americans had chronic pain. If you look at the Google hits for chronic pain, you find 46 million in 2016, 163 million in 2017. This is last year's slide, so it indicates 52 million so far in 2018. But that number at the end of the year was up over 200 million. So chronic pain is an issue here. What is causing all this? I believe that we know that addiction is basically a problem in the brain. And my thinking is that this chronic pain is also a problem in the brain. People are experiencing real pain, but it's basically beginning in the brain. They want to treat it with painkillers. That doesn't really work. The chronic pain doesn't go away. Okay, so the face of the addict. This is also important in terms of the transition of heroin addicts over time. In the 60s and 70s, the heroin addict was considered to be young, to be someone from the inner city, mostly minority men and minorities, and Vietnam vets. Later in the 1980 to 2000, we see a lot more older African-American men, and then more use in suburbs, but they're still young, poor, minority males dominating the statistics over addiction. Today, the fastest growing proportions of addicts are typically female, they're typically older, middle income, and white, and more rural than urban. So the face, the typical user, addict, has changed dramatically from people that society doesn't care about. Now it's hitting basically middle America, middle income America, the school teachers, the football players, the coal miners, the fishermen, the factory workers, the carpenters, construction workers. These are people who regularly get injured and regularly have to be treated in a medical facility. If you ever have the unfortunate need to go to the Auburn University Medical Clinic, you typically have to wait a long time to actually see a doctor or a physician's assistant. And I've had times when I've had to wait out there for an hour or more. And typically what you'll see is one or two of the workers from the university come in to be treated by the university doctors. So they've gotten some injury on the job. And so they go to the doctors and they get free treatment here at the Auburn University Medical Facility. So here's the key. What is the cause of all this? What is the cause, not of the chronic pain, that's still, nobody really knows, but what's causing all of this addiction in the economy? You certainly wouldn't think that people would want to become addicted for the most part. Okay, is it suppliers? Is it the cartels, the smugglers, and the dealers? A lot of people think that. Is it the demanders, the drug addicts? Is it the gateway theory of, you know, a kid who smoked a little pot when they were a teenager, 10 years later ends up on heroin or these prescriptions? Is it just the darn free market that's doing this? It's making things so cheap and available and so forth that people are becoming addicted. Or is it, one theory is it's China's fault, because that's where a lot of the fentanyl is coming in and the fentanyl is really the dangerous one, whereas if you were taking black heroin and smoking black heroin, it's hard to die from that. But if you happen to take some pills that were made illegally, they might not contain heroin. They might contain fentanyl, which can be 100 times more potent than heroin itself. A lot of people on the street would agree that it's all these things, that it's China, that it's the free market, that it's the addicts themselves, or it's the cartels and the smugglers and the dealers. But all of those reasons are just the seen reasons. Okay, Frederick Bastiat, the great French liberal economist of the 19th century, said that legislation produces seen effects, but legislation also produces unseen effects. Everybody kind of can get the seen effects, but it's very difficult to see the unseen effects. Those are what the economists are going to be looking for, you know, so we pass a piece of legislation that provides $100 billion for people in poverty. So the seen part is people in poverty getting a bunch of money. The unseen factor is there's an increase in taxes or an increase in national debt, which suppresses economic activity in the present. And as a result, we shrink the economic pie. But in Washington, D.C., they don't really ever consider that increased taxes or increased spending is going to ultimately shrink the economic pie and make it more difficult for people to get jobs, to provide food, clothing, and shelter for their families. A lot of different extensive problems that are not seen. So most people will argue for more prohibition, more government interventions, more treatments. They recently passed the Opioid Crisis Treatment Act of 2018, and it contains a hodgepodge of various, you know, ways to shut down smugglers in the harbors, to treat addicts in facilities, to especially try to prevent illegal importing of fentanyl from China. So here are the real reasons. Heroin and opiates do have legitimate uses, but are addictive and very dangerous. This is why they were typically only used in hospitals on a very limited basis. So if you were in the hospital and you were in pain, they would treat you with some of these pills or possibly morphine on a drip, injected. But they would be in control of how much you consumed, basically, and how long you consumed it. And so it was very difficult for people to become addicted. As a matter of fact, one of the elements of the support for changing the prescription guidelines was a letter to the editor by a graduate student who was working on a research project where they looked at 40,000 people who went into the hospital and had at least some opioid prescription pills or injections. 40,000. And only 1 in 10,000 actually had addiction issues after they left the hospital. But the problem with that data is it represents limited use given to you by a professional for a matter of a few days. So it was used in hospitals, and it was used to treat chronic pain in cancer victims who were terminal, basically. So that they weren't worried about terminal cancer patients becoming addicted because they didn't have any way of helping them anyways, any other way. Government intervention in the economy creates these addiction problems. I've been studying this issue of illegal drugs now for many decades, and I think the basic conclusion that researchers have found is that problems that people have in society, many of which are economic problems, lack of a job, a lack of a house, or social issues, interacting with your friends, social problems, interacting with your parents or your family. This is when people often return or turn to illegal drugs as a way of masking those problems. And so all forms of government intervention make it more difficult to get jobs. It makes it more difficult to accumulate wealth. It makes it more likely that people are going to experience bouts of unemployment, loss of assets, all sorts of negative things. For example, of that is that American soldiers in Vietnam, which was a terrible place to be, where there was a good chance you might be killed or injured, they turned to heroin in massive numbers while they were soldiers over in Vietnam. And then only a small minority of those soldiers actually had trouble beating their addiction when they returned to the United States. So it was clearly that that negative environment induced them to take up drugs. The iron law of prohibition over the gateway theory of drugs, well, this is a problem as well. The gateway theory of drugs says that if you smoke pot in one day, that pretty soon you're going to be hooked on heroin. So pot or cannabis or marijuana opens the gate to the use of higher drugs. And I've actually been in debates where law enforcement and public officials have actually made that argument. But that argument has been dismissed from various disciplines. They have not found any connection there. In economics and sociology and social work, it's been debunked in biology, medicine, and so forth. It's just not true that taking one type of drug is going to lead you to becoming a heroin addict. Okay, the only connection that the gateway theory has, that if you try cannabis or marijuana or something and you end up being a heroin addict, because that does happen, but the only connection they found is that if you found a dealer to sell you pot, then you've already entered that black market of the economy. You've already gained access to illegal drugs, so you have better access to other types of illegal drugs. The iron law of prohibition is something that I wrote about in my dissertation, in my book, The Economics of Prohibition, and that's available online as a PDF on the Mises website. You just put Economics of Prohibition, my last name, and PDF in Google, and you'll be brought to a link where you can download it. So that iron law of prohibition is basically the more you try to enforce prohibition, the more dangerous drugs are going to become. Specifically, the more potent the drugs are going to become. So that might be more law enforcement officials, more prisons, more people at the border, more people searching ships as they enter the country, or just raising the penalties. Instead of a one-year prison sentence, make it a five-year prison sentence. And what will happen is that the suppliers and the smugglers will switch to smaller, more concentrated forms of illegal drugs. So, for example, when they cracked down, Ronald Reagan cracked down on the war on drugs beginning in 1984, They basically tried to seal off the border of Florida from anything getting in. And they did stop people from trying to smuggle marijuana into the state of Florida. But they started smuggling cocaine instead. And then shortly after that, people figured out how to turn cocaine into crack. And that's when it unleashed the crack epidemic in the United States. And this is the main reason why the war on drugs and prohibition fails. Because if prohibition causes all of these other problems and doesn't prevent people from using illegal drugs, and it makes drugs more potent and more dangerous, then it's pretty obvious that no matter how much we do in terms of the war on drugs, the only thing we can do is make it worse, ending up with more people dead, obviously more people in prison, more people in emergency rooms. Now, here's the biggest problem with respect to this epidemic, is that the drug companies and the American Medical Association changed the prescription writing guidelines to induce prescribing of opioids, and hence the epidemic. And this obviously is one of the unseen causes of the epidemic. Most people, including doctors, public officials that I've been talking to for the last, let's see, this is 2019, so it's been about 8 or 9 years that I've been trying to talk up this crisis. It still really hasn't sunk into the public imagination, the public knowledge of this issue. So as I mentioned, heroin is addictive. It was invented in Europe by the Bayer Pharmaceutical Company in the late 19th century. And it was originally sold as a non-addictive form of morphine, or a substitute for morphine, and a cough suppressant, which it's actually apparently pretty good at doing, and a few other things that it can do medicinally to help people. But, of course, evidence soon mounted that heroin was also addictive. It's actually more addictive. And Bayer Pharmaceutical took the product off the market and introduced another painkiller that they had discovered called aspirin, which actually is also dangerous. Because if you take aspirin, it's pretty good at relieving pain, but it also causes a little bleeding in your stomach. Some people, and that's why they prescribe it for people with heart disease, so it leaches the iron out of your system, but it can get out of control. Even though Bayer took the product off of the market, the Harrison Narcotics Act was passed in 1914, banning all sales, free market sales of narcotics. Okay, and I mentioned government intervention. This drives people to demand drugs, mind-altering drugs. War is a big part of that, and we see that in widespread use today as soldiers come back from Afghanistan and Iraq. The number of people with PTSD and injuries is very large. They need painkillers. Another area that I mentioned earlier is when government hands out monopoly privileges, it takes away opportunities from others. This is all part of the unseen activity of government, the activity of government intervention. So if the government hands out a monopoly over here, this row of students is going to have a monopoly able to raise their price and increase their profits, whereas that same monopoly may rule out that row of students from entering this profession, even though they're qualified. So as a result, they're going to have to take a less desirable, lower income, lower wage job. And so you advantage one group, but you simultaneously disadvantage another group. You impoverish another group. And the result is a lot of dysfunctional people here in the United States who need relief, who need escape. I don't bring the statistics in here on that because it's a matter of degree, right? We're probably all at least a little bit dysfunctional some of the time. But we're talking about the people who are severely dysfunctional almost all of the time. Those are the people that are going to be most attracted to this problem. So all of this is the unseen. Monopoly privileges restrict supply, increase price, and reduce job opportunities. So not only does that group over there end up with less income, but when they go to get the services of the people over in this group, they have to pay higher prices. Okay, so if this group is doctors, and this group is not doctors, they have to, you know, maybe work the counter at the doctor's office. So their income is lower, but if they want to go see the doctor, they have to pay higher prices. And in the U.S. economy, basically now, there are over 600 professions that require some sort of license. And the average license takes about a year to get here in the United States. It basically, in terms of lost income and the amount of money you have to pay, it's about $20,000 to get that license. And as I said, the licensing is widespread, and it's actually worse in some other countries. Okay, here's the Iron Law of Prohibition. It states that when alcohol and drugs are prohibited and produced in the black market, they will be produced in a more concentrated form. Okay, so when we look at alcohol prohibition, what we saw was prior to alcohol prohibition starting in 1920, Americans drank beer, they drank wine, and they drank whiskey-like products. When prohibition started in 1920, the market quickly moved, so there was almost no beer produced, almost no wine was produced, and 90% of all alcohol consumed was spirits, whiskeys, gin, vodka type products. They were typically made at 160 proof rather than 80 proof. And they were not made commercially, but they were made in the black market. So they typically smelled bad, tasted bad, and looked bad. So it was dangerous. The deaths and disease related to alcohol during the 1920s didn't go down at all. And it was actually called the age of the cocktail because there were so many different cocktail recipes that were put together to try to cover up the smell, try to cover up the taste, and to try to cover up what it actually looked like. You know, if you see a bottle of vodka and it's kind of hazy, you kind of, well, wait a second. Got anything better than that? So that's the Iron Law of Prohibition as applied to alcohol in terms of drugs. I did a study in my dissertation where I looked at the potency of cannabis or marijuana. And in 1972, when Nixon's war on drugs began, the average potency of marijuana was 0.4 of 1%. 12 years later, in 1984, it was 4.4%. So it increased by a factor of 10 in about a 12-year period. I had this government report about the potency of cannabis, and I called him up as I was finishing up my dissertation, and I said, could you send me the latest bulletin that you produce on this? And there was silence on the other side of the phone, and he said, where did you get that report? I said, somebody from your office sent it to me. And they said, you're not supposed to have that report. I said, really? I didn't know that. And I asked him, should I send it back to you? Which I did, after I made 3 or 4 copies. So as enforcement efforts or penalties increase or intensify, suppliers have the interest, their own self-interest, to switch to more powerful and more concentrated substitutes. So marijuana or cannabis was big in the 1960s and 70s. In the 80s, there was the most popular drug was cocaine and the variation called crack cocaine. And then in the 90s to the present, there's been more types of synthetic drugs like fentanyl, methamphetamines or meth, and then other chemical drugs as well. So they haven't been able to shut it down at all. And the net effect is that in trying to shut the flow of illegal drugs into the United States or anywhere else, it just gives the suppliers and the smugglers the incentive to turn to something that's much more dangerous and much more deadly. For example, the switch from marijuana to cocaine that I mentioned that happened in the state of Florida. And so this iron law of prohibition is really the flip side, the correct side of the gateway theory, that there is this tendency to go from marijuana to heroin in the marketplace, not because of the gateway theory, but because law enforcement efforts have intensified and created this incentive for suppliers and smugglers. Okay, so we've got these millions of Americans receiving prescriptions. They get a 60-day, 90-day prescription, maybe for 90 to 120 pills per month. But as soon as their leg is healed, their shoulder is healed, they can't go back to the doctor and get more prescriptions. So for real injuries, which is driving this phenomenon, you get a lot of pills up front, but then you're cut off. If you're part of the percentage that become addicted in that time, what do you do? What are your options? You can go cold turkey. That is dangerous. It doesn't work very often. And actually, if you are successful in getting off of these drugs, if you go back to them, is very often when people die. So say you took pills for 60 days and you were addicted and you went cold turkey and you got off these drugs. If you ever go back to them, your system will shut down basically, especially if you're taking a very large dose. So cold turkey is trouble. It's possible. You can go into a drug treatment program, but again, those are very expensive. If you don't have insurance, you're not going to be able to afford it. And they don't often work either. So their percentage of success beyond 6 months is very low. So the other alternative when you're at this point is going to the black market for an opiate. So the problem here with these black market Oxycontin and Vicodin is that they tend to be very high in price. So they can be $10 a pill, but they can also be $25 a pill based on local supply and demand conditions. And what if you're used to taking 12 of these a day? That's $120 or maybe $300 a day. That doesn't seem like the average American, average anybody, is going to be able to afford that for very long. Plus, there's uncertain supply about these things. That's why it can range from $10 on the low end to $25 on the high end. And there are price spikes as well. So this dealer that you've been buying these pills from in the black market might also be selling heroin. And heroin is actually cheaper than the pills themselves. So instead of $10 to $25, if you buy a large number of doses of heroin, they come out to about an average price of $4. Okay, black market heroin can be a problem because it's not commercially made, it's pharmaceutically made. Street heroin has a lot of impurities in it, just like a lot of other illegal drugs and the alcohol from the 1920s. It's unknown and has highly variable potency. So you might be buying heroin that's very low potency, and the next time you buy it, they may have spiked it with fentanyl, which again is up to 100 times more potent than average heroin. It contains unknown fillers in order to enhance its potency, like fentanyl. And so black market heroin results in about 21,000 overdose deaths per year. And that figure is actually much higher now. Well, solutions. That legislation that I told you about that was passed in 2018 had all kinds of provisions in it. A lot of people on the right want to simply lock up drug addicts. That's not likely to work. The left also suggests locking them up. So their solutions basically boil down to locking them up, getting them off the streets. And of course, we've already know that those approaches don't work. But I would suggest that legalization does. That's what you came to hear, right? Well, let me make my case for the legalization of things like heroin and cannabis or marijuana. Addicts actually self-report that cannabis is one of the things that helped them get off of their addiction. Another thing that they report is that if they live long enough, they usually beat their addiction. The problem is many people don't live long enough to get to that point. And of course, drug addicts have all sorts of problems, economic problems, social problems. They don't have a job. They can't keep a job. They don't have family support. They've ruined a lot of their friendships. They've stolen money from friends and family. Okay, so it's a very bad situation. Legalization would involve an addict going to a doctor and saying they're an addict and getting a prescription for commercially made pharmaceutical grade pain-killing drugs, such as heroin. So the price would no longer be an issue. The erratic supply would no longer be an issue. They wouldn't have to fret over where they're going to get their next dose. They could get a job, they could clean up their lives and have a long enough time in order to do all those things without worrying, without being sick from bad drugs. And as I said before, cannabis is one of the things that help people get off of such illegal drugs, because cannabis is a painkiller, it's a relaxant, it's an appetite stimulant. It does all the things you would like to get done in a drug treatment facility, but at a very low cost. Okay, legal cannabis might be just a few dollars a day. Legal heroin, commercially sold and made, would just be a few dollars a day. And again, addicts self-report that they were able to beat their addiction because they lived long enough and well enough to be in a position to do so on their own. It's obviously not a perfect solution, but I think it's probably one of the best available solution that doesn't involve massive expenditures by the federal government. Thank you very much.